Welcome, everybody. My name is Claire Farrell. I'm one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion. Today, I'm having a conversation with Delton Chen. The first time I came across your work was actually, I think, way back in about 2018, 2019, when we were just starting Extinction Rebellion, and you emailed a bunch of us saying that you had a concept for economics that included a kind of recognition of entropy. And it was very heady and felt like it was trying to bring physics into economics in a way which was way above my pay grade. And then more recently, you sort of reappeared and we met up and had a long conversation over coffee. Do you want to just say a little bit about who you are, Delton?
My name's Delton. I'm an engineer by training. I live in Australia, and it's true, some of the work that I've done is a bit heady. It sounds a bit complex, but I'd really like to demystify it and keep it simple, keep it practical. What I do is interdisciplinary analysis. Being an engineer, I was very curious about climate change. My work experience involves hydrology, groundwater resources. I did a doctorate on the Great Barrier Reef studying nutrient dynamics and forest evapotranspiration. And I've worked in mining and agriculture, geothermal energy. And for about the past 10 years, I've been working on climate mitigation. I founded the Global Carbon Reward Policy, and I've been working on that policy and theory for the past 10 years. Just recently, I was able to present at COP28 at some side events, and I also presented at the Bank of England. And it was around that time, actually, I met you in person.
Tell me, first of all, something about the genesis of this thinking. Where did it begin?
Sometimes it is possible to solve complex problems with intuition, using intuition as a starting point, particularly if the problem is complex. So intuition doesn't always work. You do need a lot of experience technically before intuition becomes really useful. But there is a method of solving complex problems. It's kind of reverse engineering. You assume something about the economy or how to solve a problem like climate change. And I assume that we need a new instrument, which is a currency-like tool that can be used to fund climate mitigation and would be managed or supported by central banks so that we can solve the climate finance problem. Now, just recently, I'm at the point where I'm going to try and publish another paper and then complete the policy white paper for the Global Carbon Reward. And I do believe that it does make sense. It ticks a lot of boxes. It appears to answer some very important questions about how to manage systemic risk and why we have this political gridlock over climate change. We're not making a lot of progress. We're kind of moving along with incrementalism. And this is in itself a systemic risk. And then we have downstream systemic risks with the Earth systems. So we're now learning about positive feedbacks in the climate system, tipping elements, tipping points, and cascading events. What that implies is that the climate system is inherently unstable, and we have to be careful we don't go past those tipping points. So that's another kind of systemic risk, which is downstream. But the political gridlock is really an upstream systemic risk. So the work I've done theoretically is to try and frame these problems in a logical way and mesh it into standard economic theory to explain what's gone wrong with the standard theory, which is very strongly supported by the work of Arthur Pigou, who proposed the idea of externalities, positive, negative externalities. But that theory is 100 years old. So you've got to ask the question, maybe there's more going on with the climate crisis. It doesn't seem to fit the mold of just a standard market failure.
It feels to me like the siloing of disciplines is a problem in and of itself in this set of circumstances and this problem. I know it's like important for people to have specialisms and be sensitive to specialist information, but it feels really important for people to get a view, a wider view. And like you say, the I think people are a bit frightened of the term intuition when actually suppressing it seems to be repressing something very important at a time when we need to be able to think in a more whole kind of sense. The story of Nordhaus doing the economics work for the IPCC space and getting a Nobel Prize, even though a lot of scientists checked his homework later and went, "That's absurd. It doesn't make any sense. You can't think like that." Maybe just go on and explain what's new in terms of your concept of a global carbon reward.
First of all, I agree with you that the silo effect is a serious problem for humanity. Everybody is a specialist nowadays, whether you're a hairdresser, a bus driver, a climate scientist, engineer, a lawyer, everyone's specialized. And when you specialize, you have your own language and conceptual models of the world. And I've noticed that economists have their own conceptual model based on the stuff they read, and it's different to the natural sciences, it's different to engineering. This is why it's such an interesting problem. What actually is going wrong in this neoclassical economic approach of William Nordhaus? Personally, I think that William Nordhaus's work is conceptually correct within the neoclassical model. What the main criticism is about his work are the numbers. So the numbers he has in his computer model are very conservative, and they kind of suggest that we could go to 3 or 4 degrees of warming and not worry too much. I'm not sure if that's exactly what he's saying, but that's the kind of output that he gave from his modeling work. Where I'm more interested is not the inputs and outputs of his model. What I'm interested in are the actual concepts. Now, what makes my work unique is that I'm saying that there's a major difference between costs and risks. So the neoclassical approach is framed by costs or damages called the social cost of carbon, called the damages. It's the Pigouvian approach, cost-benefit analysis. Now, if you think about costs, we experience them all the time. I'll give you an example. How much does it cost to run your car for the year? Well, you know how far you drive, and you can sort of add up the bills and the maintenance costs, and you can come to a number. That's a cost. Important is that it's predictable. The problem there is that we have another dimension to our reality, which is risk. So risk is unique in that it's not predictable. For example, if you cross the street on a busy road, you don't just cross the street whenever it suits you. It might save you time just to cross, but you could get hit by a bus or something. And so there's a risk. Now, how much would that risk cost you, getting hit by a bus? It's very hard to know. It could cost anywhere from $1 to $1 million or your life. And so those sorts of problems are risk-based. And the standard economic theory doesn't have a framework for dealing with systemic risks very well. It's kind of an issue which is fuddled around. So what I've done is I've built a wider framework that points to the idea that we can price the systemic risks. And what's interesting is that it appears to me, at least, that we are missing a policy that is specialized for that very purpose. Now, if it's true, we're missing a policy to price the systemic risks and manage those systemic risks. What would you expect to happen? We wouldn't be able to manage them. And this is what we see. So what we're seeing in terms of systemic risk are two types. There's an upstream risk and a downstream risk. The upstream is where the political elite cannot make decisions regarding rapid decarbonization. There's a political gridlock, which I believe is related to the global financial system and the debt-based structure of finance, including, of course, our monetary system. It's a debt-based monetary system. So with so much debt and debt-based investing, it's very difficult for politicians to take a very aggressive decarbonisation pathway because they will lose the support of all the business people and backers. So that's the upstream systemic risk. And the downstream is the planet itself, in that there are different Earth systems, including the climate system, that have a propensity to become unstable with higher concentrations of greenhouse gases and higher temperatures. These are nowadays talked about in terms of tipping elements. The climate system appears to be inherently unstable with positive feedbacks. If we go too far with emissions and warming, we could, for example, cause a lot of methane and CO2 to come out of thawing permafrost, or the Amazon could burn down, or the AMOC, Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, could destabilize, and that would cause major changes to the planet, and so on and so forth. So they're possible tipping points, are also positive feedbacks, and they can cascade into each other. So all of that complexity is very difficult to predict. You can't really predict it because we don't have the models that are calibrated for this dynamic reality. If you don't have models, how do you plug it into an economic model? You can't really. So the issue we have is that we don't really have the theoretical framework for dealing with the systemic risks. And the work I've done is to incorporate that into the neoclassical model. So we have a bigger model now. And what I'm saying is that if we do implement this policy, global carbon reward, my personal prediction is that it will make a massive difference. It will be kind of like night and day, in that a lot more decarbonisation will happen very quickly. There'll be much more cooperation. Finance won't be so much of a problem. The amount of investing in new technologies will skyrocket, and there'll be rapid change. The kind of change you would expect to see in this kind of situation.
That sounds good. I'm sure there's a lot of details to think about, and especially the deep criticisms of neoclassical economics and capitalism itself. You know, there's a lot of conversations that run quite deep and quite far in our space that would be critical of that. So I'll ask you some more questions to go a bit further. That's an overview of the economic resolution, kind of conceptually. And then what about ecological? Because, you know, since we started Extinction Rebellion, we really tried to pull together the climate with the extinction crisis and with biodiversity loss. It can feel quite hard to hold both. And I think often, you know, people are talking about one or the other. So I've spoken to you before about how this can support regenerative outcomes. And I didn't find that clear from my first sort of initial encounter with the idea, and obviously talking about fitting something to a neoclassical model is not going to make most people think, oh, this could be regenerative by design. So can you talk about ecology and the related issue, I guess, of carbon offsets and the greenwashing and the, you know, the bullshit basically that's gone on around this topic as well?
There's quite a few topics there to unpack. I might start with the greenwashing from carbon credits and offsetting. If you know something about offsetting, it's basically saying a polluter, rather than reducing their emissions at the factory or wherever they do their business, they say, well, it's a bit difficult to do, a bit expensive, so why don't we buy some offsets from the Amazon or Africa or from someplace in the world where they're mitigating. And the problem with that is it tends to promote business as usual, and it opens the door to greenwashing and certain kinds of corruption because there's a lot of steps involved in those exchanges. The carbon reward is interesting because it straight away removes that problem, even given that the carbon reward, it's a debt-free payment for mitigation, but it doesn't involve any offsetting. So we don't need to rely on the offsetting to pay for the reward. It's paid for through a different approach involving central banks. And so what that means is we can just focus on doing the mitigation, avoid the offsetting, and that will immediately solve a lot of problems, particularly if the finance is scalable. And also, if the finance has a predictable long-term price, it introduces a lot more stability in the whole market. And businesses and investors who want to do really big projects to pull a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere or to decarbonize a great deal, they can plan ahead and invest a lot more money because the price signal is much more reliable over many decades, if not centuries. That's the first point. So the other points you raised was the global carbon reward sounds a bit neoclassical or a bit cold, not really kind of embracing the notion of life and regeneration. Well, there are two levels of understanding here about nature and ecosystems. I might just start with the theoretical first. What's really interesting about the policy is that it does have a high-level conceptual model. For instance, if you listen to ecological economists, they like to talk about steady state economy, circular economy, and they have little diagrams to show civilization as a subsystem of nature. Well, in this approach, there is a model, and it's to do with stocks and flows of materials and energy. And our model is a bit different because it's theoretically aligned with the way ecosystems actually work, complex ecosystems on the Earth's surface. So in an oxygenated environment, all complex life is existing via two metabolic pathways, respiration and photosynthesis. In actual fact, there's a plant behind you, so we could look at that plant just for inspiration. But that plant, like all plants, they have actually evolved from different organisms. So plants didn't exist on the Earth actually until about 500 million years ago, roughly. And when they did evolve, they began with the eukaryotes, and then they embodied blue-green algae. And the blue-green algae evolved into chloroplast. And so it's actually a symbiosis. Plants are a symbiotic relationship between photosynthesizing cells and respiring cells. And that's the model for plants. And plants can actually achieve carbon neutrality. So there's a thermodynamic relationship there where a plant is a self-contained system. It can achieve carbon neutrality and survive indefinitely through that process. When you go to a larger system like an ecosystem, it's actually still very similar. It's just that you have respiration occurring in fungi and animals as well, and plants do photosynthesis generally. So all the relationships are exchanges of energy between respiration and photosynthesis. It's just that the exchanges depend on whether it's sugar, feeding, or decomposition, and so on. So we take that basic model and we reapply it to our systems model for civilization. And essentially what we're saying is we need to have compartmentalized economies, one dealing with consumption and production, because that's kind of like respiration, it's exothermic. But we need another economy in parallel, complementary, that's specialized for mitigation, that's pulling carbon out the atmosphere and decarbonization. So that's analogous to photosynthesis. And this is a framing to understand how the policy works and to understand how to regulate civilization to get control of the carbon cycle, target net zero globally sometime this century, avoid a catastrophe. I'll just go only that far in explaining it because it starts to get very technical quite quickly. It's called the living systems economy. It's not published yet, but I have the draft papers and the analysis. Now, the other part of the conversation that you brought up was regeneration. To understand this, I would simply say it's not enough to a target, say, 500 parts per million or 350 parts per million in the atmosphere or a carbon budget. Those ideas, in my mind, are a problem because it's oversimplifying. What we need to manage is the whole carbon cycle, including the biosphere, because it's a system. A safe carbon cycle will have an ecosystem, a planetary ecosystem that is regenerative. Because if it's not regenerative, with biodiversity and reproduction and so on, it will become unstable and it will lose carbon. So it only makes sense to include in the policy a facility to promote ecological protection, regeneration, protect biodiversity, and so on. And similarly, we can say the same thing about human societies. If human societies and communities are regenerative rather than the opposite, incoherent, they will be more stable, and the carbon that is exchanged in those communities will also be more stable. Because you need stable societies to be able to manage these sophisticated problems of climate mitigation and high technology. Now, the policy, it includes secondary price signals based on weightings of rewards to literally promote those co-benefits, the regenerative co-benefits. And that particular part of the policy would be done through a very decentralized platform that just invites all stakeholders to organically form their own stakeholder groups to begin ranking and point scoring all the mitigation projects that exist and influence their lives and their environment. So that's a very brief explanation for the way it works. There's obviously more detail, and it hasn't been fully fleshed out. It's just the framework at this stage for that part of the policy.
Just because I don't know loads about economics, can you? I'm probably going to be helpful to ask like basic questions. Can you just say what a secondary price signal is? So to make sure.
Sure, sorry. Okay. When we want to control the carbon balance, the carbon cycle, we want to put a price on mitigation, pay people to do the good work through paying per ton, for example. Now, if we do that, we can get the tonnage, but we need another lever to pull to incentivize the regenerative activities. So the way that's the secondary price signal. So the primary price signal is this price per ton. That's quantitative. And then we need another price signal that works on the qualitative, like the feel good, regenerative biodiversity topics, which have a lot of context and a lot of detail and subjectivity. So for that, the secondary price signal is simply taking some of the rewards from the bad projects and giving it to the good projects. If you follow that simple formula, take from the bad projects, give to the good projects, it solves a lot of problems because you're not creating or destroying these rewards. You're just redistributing them to promote the outcomes we prefer. It'll create competition for regeneration. That's the basic concept.
One of the things that we talked about before was the fact that the central banks use QE, quantitative easing, to, create money out of thin air. And this has been massively problematic, obviously, for like the escalating, spiraling inequality and the concentration of money in certain parts of the system or our societies. And whilst lots of people are becoming more and more poor and even more and more destitute, even in very wealthy countries like this, since 2008, and everyone has heard the famous phrase, they got bailed out and we got sold out. There's been, I think, a greater understanding in the general public that there are serious problems with the fact that people can just make billions of pounds and chuck it at whatever they feel like in political sense, it whilst under a crisis. And so there's a sort of element of your proposal working with the system as it stands that is a type of QE, isn't it? And so can you speak a little bit to that, which I think you've been calling it carbon QE?
Yeah, carbon QE. This is a big story, and it's a very layered story. Like we might need 5 or 10 minutes just to kind of give it some context, but I'll try and talk through it really quickly. Well, first of all, Quantitative easing, basically, it's where the central bank prints bank reserves from nothing, which they can do, and they use that new money to buy financial assets. That's conventional QE, and it was used to stabilize the financial system during the 2008-9 global financial crisis. So they bought financial institutions in distress and whatever else assets they bought. It's a way of also of stimulating the economy when interest rates are already very, very low or zero. So that's kind of the basic story. But what's more nuanced about this story is that the way our economy works is that when money is created, most of it is actually created not by the central banks. They actually don't create much, that much at all. It's mainly created by commercial banks. Now, why is that? Well, because it's the money created by commercial banks that actually circulates to businesses and people like you and I. The money that the central banks create stays in a different system. It's the bank reserves in the interbank system. It's the bank accounts for financial institutions, which is a different type of system. It's not the system we use. And the system we use is bigger, and it's on the outside, and that's on the inside. So my point is, if you look at what commercial banks do when they create money as loans, they tend to lend money and create money for particular reasons. And those reasons tend to be big corporates and real estate and safe bets for the big businesses. They're not that interested in lending to the little guys, small and medium-sized businesses, and so they tend to suffer. So some experts in this field say, look, if you want a healthy, robust economy, you need the commercial banks to lend a lot more to the little guys, and that can really improve employment and have a lot of benefits. So that's an important backstory. And this leads on to the other concept of quantitative easing. The originator of quantitative easing, Richard Werner, he actually wanted the central banks not to print the money to buy the assets from Wall Street, but to print the money to spend in the productive sectors of the economy where you make stuff and do stuff, because that would employ people, if you see what I mean. And what happens if you use this new money produced from QE to buy financial assets? You're bumping up the value of those assets. The rich get richer, the poor don't get richer, they maybe get poorer. It increases inequality. It does stabilize the system for the reasons that they believe, but it has a long-term detrimental effect on society because of inequality. And so they haven't quite come to terms with that. Now let's look at carbon quantitative easing. So carbon quantitative easing is not a kind of QE that just happens sporadically because the financial system is about to collapse or anything like that. It's going to be a very long term, over hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's going to happen forever type thing. And it'll be very strategic. And it's going to support the policy, global carbon reward, the instrument called carbon currency. And that currency is going directly to the productive sectors. So it will create jobs and it will fund the mitigation and regeneration we need. And so when the central banks are doing the carbon quantitative easing, what they're doing in effect is not so much expanding the money supply to buy this carbon currency. What in effect they're doing is something a bit more nuanced and much, much more strategic. What they're in effect doing is saying that if this carbon currency falls in value below a certain level, they're going to defend its value. They're going to buy it up if its value gets too low. And they're going to defend the value of this carbon currency into the future to follow a schedule. So it'll have a rising schedule over decades to solve the problem. And if they back this floor price with carbon QE, some magic happens. And the magic is that this asset becomes investable. It's actually an investment because you can buy it at the beginning, sell it later, and make a profit possibly. And what that means is, with this guarantee from central banks, this carbon QE, We expect the private sector to buy it in huge amounts. And that way, we're reallocating investment and wealth and capital from everything else that's going on and putting it into climate mitigation through this mechanism. And it's a mechanism that should appeal to Wall Street and appeal to the average person in the street because we could all participate in this investment opportunity. Like, if you're listening and you happen to invest in Bitcoin, you might understand whilst Bitcoin might be exciting, it does crash from time to time and you don't have a lot of certainty in the future. But with this carbon currency, you have a lot of certainty and you can invest in it for the long term. So that's kind of the carbon QE in a nutshell.
Obviously, that's going to run into the degrowthers and the people who think that the growth imperative embedded in our system is, ultimately a problem. But I'll come back to that. First, I just want to ask you, if you did all of that and it got implemented by everybody who's subscribed to the Paris Climate Accord, what would happen?
Well, it's well known actually that there's a huge climate finance gap to try and achieve the Paris goals. It's roughly 3 trillion per year for conventional mitigation, and it will increase to about a trillion a year for carbon removal from the atmosphere, removal and storage. So you're talking roughly 3, 4 trillion a year for a very long time.
And that's before you even talk about the loss and damage fund, which is a sort of, which is a pitiful, insulting amount in a little pot at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, that's another story. Loss and damage, and the Green Climate Fund as well. They all suffer. And actually, it's worth commenting on this point. Why does the Green Climate Fund and the Loss and Damage Fund suffer? Why can't countries just pile lots of money in? Well, it's because our financial system is debt-based. It's very difficult to come across money in surplus that you can just give away as grants because all the money in existence has actually got a counterbalance of debt. So most of the money is created as debt. That means it's a loan. That means somebody has to find the money to pay back their loans with interest. That's why money is so scarce. And that's why we have this problem. And that's one reason. There are other reasons too, political, that I don't put a lot of hope or faith in these funds that come out of COP meetings. They tend to really suffer. But I think we've gone off track a little bit. Can you get me back on track, please, Claire? I think I.
No problem. I just wanted to know what would happen if all the countries that signed the Paris Agreement implemented the framework that you're suggesting. What do you think would happen?
Well, I mentioned this huge finance gap. So the key point about the policy, it can fill that gap. Likely, I think one of the first applications will be to demonstrate to the world that we can buy out fossil fuel reserves, oil, coal, gas reserves, particularly in environmentally sensitive regions of the world, rainforests in the Amazon, Ecuador, the Congo Basin, Southeast Asia, and so on. So we can buy out these leases with the carbon currency in exchange for contracts where the owners of the fossil fuel resources have to commit to leaving that resource in the ground, not mining it, and instead building out renewable energy assets, renewable energy supply. Why? Because we need to substitute that energy because there is an energy demand in civilization. And so the idea is to leave it in the ground and replace it with renewables, but to speed up that process because it's well known that the amount of fossil fuels that are planned to be extracted is more than double that allowed for the 1.5, probably a lot more. So unless we do something like this, we're pretty well screwed. What else would happen? Well, it would require some major meetings through the UNFCCC COP meetings where the policy would be piloted and demonstrated with a few countries at first, and then a club would emerge, would get a bit bigger. And then at some point, there would need to be a point in time when political leaders are under enough pressure that they will take it seriously and realize we need it. It's not just a kind of novel idea. It simply makes sense because we're talking about trillions of dollars a year over decades, and that money needs to be reliable and it needs to be bankable. I think environmentalists maybe don't think enough about what it's like to be a business person or investor in these big projects. So all big projects have to be funded either with debt or equity. And when you go to a bank for a loan, for example, you've got to prove to the lender that your project can actually make a profit. And if you're in a developing country, that's difficult because interest rates are high due to the sovereign risk and so on. So with this carbon reward, it solves a lot of those problems because when projects in developing countries and everywhere else can report their carbon currency earnings into the future, the lenders and the investors will take those forecasts seriously, and they will say, yeah, this is bankable because that carbon currency is backed by central banks. It's got a guaranteed floor. We can make a profit. We're good to go, and stuff can happen. But at the moment, it's very difficult to get projects off the ground.
There are big questions about how transitions take place because of the extraction that's required, because of the destruction inherent in mining and creating the materials for all of that. And I'm increasingly joining dots in my own mind about the frame of peace, really, and cooperation and peacemaking and building. There's a brilliant woman, Olivia Lazard, who speaks very well about the geopolitical contexts of, the transition, extraction, and where the minerals are, and where the making and processing capacities are, and how that's going to really shift global power. I mean, I live in England, right? So I'm living in a country that's showing the reaction to the circumstances that it's in of cutting ties, isolating itself, stepping out of the nearest economic bloc that it can be part of, and saying, no, we're an island. And that's predicted in the climate sort of projections that I've seen that come through military and security experts. That's the least favorable option, is that rather than cooperation on a global scale, you at least want cooperation in on a sort of localized bloc scale. The worst outcome is if all the countries just isolate, retreat, and say it's everyone for themselves, and we build walls and militaries and all of that kind of stuff. What's the view from your work on kind of current geopolitics and development and peace, I guess?
Human civilization has a very interesting history, and this history is very much tied up in currencies and monetary systems for a number of reasons. And I think the history of money is very important to understand. So when I talk about a carbon currency, it might sound a little bit flaky. Maybe some people think, oh, it's another Bitcoin or a blockchain, which it isn't. Think of it in context of civilization's evolution. So one very important point in time was the end of World War II. The United States obviously was the premier economy, and it had a claim on the reserve currency status. So they pretty much decided what would take place, and they moved for the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was the US dollar as reserve currency tied to gold, and $35 per ounce of gold, something like that. And that worked for a while, but because gold is in limited supply, it began to break down. Why? Because the world economy was growing so quickly. So 1971, 73, when the gold window ended, that was actually an inflection point, the most rapid period of growth, really, of civilization. And by releasing ourselves from that gold standard, we could have more growth. We just print more money as we need it. We need to recognize that the Bretton Woods and the UN that came out of World War II, World Bank and all that, they still have a very important function to play for global cooperation. But now in the early 21st century, we see rising superpowers that are contenders for being a dominant player in the world. And so competition between superpowers for political and cultural and economic dominance. Now, we can see it playing out in real time. It appears the world is splitting into a multipolar situation between East and West. And it's a very dangerous time because a lot of the neocon political rhetoric is quite dangerous because it tends to follow an aggressive militaristic approach. We can all see that happening. We need to think about what is the right context for civilization at this particular point in time. We can't really go back in time to a different kind of monetary system based on gold or silver coins or anything like that. What my claim is, we're in a very special point of time, it's just that we haven't quite realized what it is. And in my opinion, it's a thermodynamic transition. So I'll frame it in ways that might make some sense. One way we mark time for civilization is in terms of industrial revolutions. So we had the first industrial revolution in the mid 1700s, roughly, to about the early 1800s. And that was the first factories, the first steam engines, and the beginning of urbanization began in the United Kingdom and spread outwards. Now, the second industrial revolution, I think roughly around the mid 1800s through to the early 20th century, that was unique for the beginning of globalization through electrification, telephone, TV, radio, and so on, and really ramping up production with industrial processes. The third industrial revolution, some people claim, was around maybe end of World War II, roughly, where we began a new process of digitization and global finance. And that carried on through to, some people would argue, around about now, maybe beginning of the noughties. And the new fourth industrial revolution, potentially, is advanced digital technologies like AI. It's also new material science, quantum computing, possibly, driverless cars, and all these kinds of fancy tech that are another level beyond, to a new level where they take on a quite a magical quality. And embedded in that through the internet also is social media programming, which we don't really see, but there are these emergent phenomena which a little bit weird. Now, in this fourth industrial revolution, in my opinion, what's missing is a new economic model that fits the period. And the period that we're in is unique because we are now faced with a problem where we have to take carbon out of the atmosphere, which is thermodynamically the reverse of every other period of industrial revolution and even prior to that. So prior to the first industrial revolution with agriculture, we actually survived from biofuels. So biofuels are the same process as combustion. We just moved on to fossil fuels. It's combustion. It's all the same kind of chemistry and thermodynamics. Even before that, the agricultural revolution and hunter-gatherers, we survived by making fire. It's the same thing, same thermodynamic combustion process. So now we're faced with something completely the opposite. And we haven't quite figured out that to survive on this planet, the fourth industrial revolution needs to have an economic revolution on the understanding that we have to have the capacity to do the reverse of what we're familiar with. We're not familiar with carbon dioxide removal. We find it uncanny, a bit weird. And there are debates around whether we should attempt it or not. In my opinion, these are quite naive debates and discussions. Because we absolutely do need it. It's just that we haven't quite figured out that that is definitely the future of civilization. It's a test. Unless we can master the process of carbon removal from the atmosphere and decarbonizing industry, we're pretty well screwed. The fourth industrial revolution, in my opinion, has to have not only the economic and thermodynamic dimension, it needs the monetary dimension as well. What's interesting about money is if you look back in history, not necessarily through design, but maybe trial and error, kind of just stumbling along for the right kind of model. The monetary systems that civilizations have used has always matched the energy supply. So if you go back prior to the Second Industrial Revolution and the First Industrial Revolution, we were using gold and silver predominantly. Silver coins were the world's first international currency, worked very reliably for more than 2 centuries. Then, about the time of the First World War, Second World War, we started to give up on that and move to representative currencies where the gold was held in a bank vault somewhere, and we just kind of backed money with gold and silver. And then we realized, oh, we didn't need that. Why? Not because gold and silver had changed or our attitudes have changed. No, it was because the energy supply that we were able to access was enormous, i.e., coal, oil, and natural gas. So with that huge supply of energy, growth just took off exponential-like, and then gold was no longer practical. We just released ourselves from that commodity and just went for full fiat floating exchange rates. Now we're hitting the peak of growth, and we're looking around and saying, oh my goodness, we can't continue on this way. And what's interesting is that money, fiat money, which is created as debt, it's not just a tool for economics and commerce. It actually is a catalyst for growth. It drives more growth as well as facilitates growth. So if we want to change trajectory, we're going to need other kinds of money that doesn't force us into a growth trajectory. Now, the carbon currency is interestingly, it's not actually money as a medium of exchange. You don't need it to buy anything, and you can't actually. It's purely an asset. And so it might be confusing actually to what we're talking about. What we're talking about with the carbon currency is an incentive to decarbonize, and that will get us to where we need to go. But to understand what kind of money we need in the far future, when we can't grow anymore or growth peaks, that's another question. And that's quite a nuanced one. In my opinion, when we hit peak growth and we start to plateau, we simply won't be able to rely on debt-based money. We simply swap over to other forms of fiat that don't require debt. And we actually have them in circulation. The banknotes and coins, which are issued by the central bank or treasury, are such a form of money. They're not necessarily backed by debt. It's the money in your bank account with commercial banks that's backed by debt or loans. So you just need to change the composition of the monetary system to deal with the growth problem. That's not something we need to get too worried about right now, but it's certainly a topic that needs to be discussed by people interested in degrowth. Because unless you have the right monetary system, a civilization, an economy will become hugely unstable.
It feels like you're thinking through there, like some of the things that people like Nate Hagans talk about, the sort of energy blindness of societies and people and not paying attention to how much additional energy or labor we get out of the supercharging of our societies on fossil power because it's so phenomenally powerful. And also that you are thinking about how this concept meets the ideas around limits to growth or the ideas that exist around planetary boundaries. Your thinking is inclusive of how you would prevent that permanent growth imperative and expansion from continuing to like blow further and further and further past the limits or the boundaries.
Well, the way I see it is if we do have an economic system with or without the global carbon reward that can actually deliver a safe carbon balance, by default, it will have to manage the growth problem because unless, they're both coupled problems. You can't solve one without solving the other. In my opinion, the amount of growth that we have as GDP, as a measure of growth, there are other measures, but I see that as being a dependent variable. Like, you don't need to force it to necessarily to peak. It will just peak whenever it's natural for it to peak. Why I say that is that we really need to focus on the carbon balance more so than the energy balance. The priority I place on energy is not so much how much energy we use, but what we do with it. From a systems perspective, what we need to do is allocate enough energy to the problem of decarbonization, carbon removal. And that's probably the right answer. If we don't have a lot of energy, it means we have less energy for the fun things, for, luxury items and consumption. But if we have abundant energy, and we can still manage the carbon balance and cycle, then we have more toys to play with, and I suppose quality of life would be higher. That's Mother Nature's boundary. We don't get a choice. We just have to work within Mother Nature's boundary best we can. It's my opinion that we're not going to succeed unless we have the right economic structures and incentives. And it has to make sense for the problem at hand, which is, in my opinion, it's got to be the carbon cycle first. And yes, I know there are other problems, of course. We touched on a few, such as ecological breakdown. There's other kinds of pollution. There's planetary boundaries we could talk about too. But many of the planetary boundaries actually related to the carbon cycle, either directly or indirectly. And if you don't have the carbon cycle properly managed, in effect, you're giving up on life itself because life is based on carbon. So when I talk about the carbon cycle, I'm not just talking about, the invisible gases going up in the atmosphere and chimney stacks. I literally mean every molecule of every plant, animal, and fungi and bacteria that exists on the planet. That's all part of the carbon cycle. And also, the detritus in the soil and soil carbon, that's included. Carbon in the oceans, it acidifies the oceans, that's included. All of it. That's what we got to manage. And if we can master that reasonably well, we will be in a better position to tackle other kinds of pollution and other social problems. But you got to have your framework, in my opinion. It's not an answer for everything, but you got to start somewhere.
The carbon thermostat. It's not that you turn it down and then it all stops. Other things have to stop that aren't just carbon. For example, forever chemicals and microplastic pollution in the ocean, and the crisis in the oceans, which is enormously overlooked by the big climate conversations, in my view. The nature and of the pollution and the scale of the pollution is undermining the health of the ocean such that it will sequester less carbon because it's damaging ecosystems and plankton and all the rest of it. Increasing carbon is making the world hot, but it's also more complex than that. We probably need a quite a multifaceted and open conversation where people are willing to look at things from different perspectives, from different disciplines perspectives, and really think about how we can, like we said at the start, cross-discipline collaboration, or get out of silos and see stuff from different perspectives. Because I still hear things that blow my mind on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment because you raised plastics and you raised a few issues. First of all, the silo effect, once again, I came to this space with an engineering background and I've been looking at the circular economy model for a while now, thinking about it. And I've come to my own personal interpretation or conclusion. I believe now that the circular economy model is the wrong model. For certain things such as plastics. Now, plastics are actually carbon-based, so they are part of the carbon cycle. But the problem with them is they don't actually fit into the carbon cycle because they're non-biodegradable. They're an unnatural so-called material, polymers. Why would I say that? Why would plastics not be recyclable? Well, the problem with the circular economy model is very similar to the problem with the steady state model and all those other models. They're too simple. They're based on stocks and flows, and they don't actually consider the thermodynamics and the chemistry of these materials. They're quite kind of magical thinking models. Because most people in their silos don't look at these models from a chemistry perspective, a thermodynamics perspective, I think they're being fooled. I don't think plastics can ever be recycled in the way people might think. They're either going to be burnt or landfilled, and that's it. They're your choices. If you try to recycle and you can't get 100% recycling, it'll end up in the environment eventually. And if it's a resilient material that takes 1,000 years to decompose, then we're basically going to fill up the planet with plastic, and it'll turn into microplastic and then nanoplastic. And we don't know what the implications are of microplastics and nanoplastics because it's such a novel entity. Like it gets into the brain, it gets into the bloodstream, it gets into the placenta, it's in our water, it's in our food. We don't know what it's going to do. Hopefully it won't do much, because it's too late. Once it's out there, you can't get it back. It does worry me deeply, the plastic problem. And I've already said what I thought about that circular economy model. I think it's a dangerous model because it hasn't been thought through very well. As I alluded to before, the model for the carbon cycle that I'm proposing is based on complementary systems, not on one economic system. It's two subsystems. The reasons are, once again, to do with the physics and thermodynamics of systems. But what I can't say is that I don't can't say I have a proof. This is another challenge of this work to the way science works and literature and publications and so on, is if you want to have a big impact in the academic world, they expect to see reductionist theories and formal proofs. And this type of work is so complex that it might not be possible necessarily to produce a proof, maybe for the next 20 or 30, 50 years. It could take that long. I mean, we don't really know. We're going to have to rely on different approaches as well, more empirical, heuristic, and trial and error. We're going to have to be much more experimental.
We talked before about just thinking through that circular conversation, being critical of the circular economy. And I'm very critical of the circular economy model as a sort of thing that you can stick onto my former industry, the fashion industry. People love it because it leaves everything basically the same, but you make a recycling factory. And nobody talks about the inherent waste and the problems with setting up those supply chains, the fact that we know how to do it, but no one's built the factories. Why not? You know, we don't recycle things. We don't do anything on a scale that's anywhere close to, you know, what we're producing in terms of 100 billion garments a year. So the circular economy conversation is just a, is as far as I can see in my industry, it's just a conversation, and people like it and feel better. But it's not actually keeping any textiles out of the ground hardly, and it's not really progressing businesses to like restructure themselves in a way which does keep stuff out of the ground, even if you think that that's enough, which I don't think it's enough anyway. So in my world, we've gone from sort of fashion, people saying, you know, ethical fashion, which is the first thing I started working on. And then people went off that because it's too difficult and you have to actually look after people. So then let's do sustainability because that's technical and you can still abuse human rights and all of that kind of stuff. So everyone's kind of taken a more shine to that. And then you've got the sort of circular stuff. And now the more radical end of the conversation in the fashion space, which I'm in touch with, is about defashioning. And that's very much sort of intellectually being drawn out of like the degrowth philosophy. And I think in the cultural sense, the idea of degrowth, defashion is really interesting because a dominant Western system of dress has obliterated culture all over the world in a way which has never been interrogated or included that well, I think, in a lot of the conversations, which become quite technical and just about the environment. It makes me think, well, for that space, I'm really interested in where the degrowth paradigm can take us. I don't think there's that many people in our movement who are really enticed by the green growth narrative, particularly. Some people might be, but I don't see that becoming particularly popular, but the degrowth space really is. And so, given that there's sort of feels like a binary, divergent kind of set of options in this conversation ordinarily, can you just close by describing what you see as like totally fundamentally different, what you're proposing to being sort of caught between those two options?
So we have circular economy, degrowth, green growth, and I'm putting forward a living systems economy. What does it all mean? Well, one way to look at this is that they're all tools in a toolbox. And what we need to figure out is which problems require which tools. So, for example, plastics, microfibers, and so on. My opinion at this point in time is we need to substitute the non-biodegradable plastics with biodegradable organic carbon-based substitutes. So we're going to need to invent new materials at a fundamental level, not assume that we can simply recycle all the plastic and single-use plastics. Some people might think that I'm anti-recycling. It's definitely not the case. What I'm saying is a bit more nuanced. I'm saying there are certain problems that are at the molecular level and not at the macro level of simply throwing it into a recycling bin. There are certain problems, particularly with plastics, you've got to replace the actual material and not focus on the recycling. Other materials that are more organic or benign, you can recycle them. It just might take a bit more energy and more planning. Now, degrowth, I'm not against degrowth. I'm just saying it's a tool for certain problems where groups of people, communities want to degrow. They should do that. It's a great idea. But you can't necessarily impose that tool onto the global economy because it probably won't work. You need something more sophisticated to deal with that kind of problem. Steady state. It's very similar to circular economy. It's much the same problem. The problem with steady state and circular economy is they're based on stocks and flows. So they effectively ignore chemistry and thermodynamics because you really, when you're dealing with materials, you've got to take into account the chemical reactions, the phase changes from solid, liquid to gas, entropic changes, and also got to take into account emergent social behaviors, which are real, and time. So when you take a snapshot of, say, the circular economy or steady state economy, everything looks okay, but very slight imbalances can compound over time. And what looks sustainable in this simple model isn't necessarily. So there are really inherent significant problems in these models. And the challenge for humanity is to figure out why the models are not suitable for such problems as plastics and climate change and carbon. So that's where my focus is. If people are watching and are interested, I'm more than happy to give presentations and invite me to workshops or conferences or whatever. But just so people understand also my time constraints, I'm currently writing a paper and the policy white paper, and I really want to get those completed by around mid-year and release our policy white paper towards the end of this year before Climate Week. In around September. So if there's anyone listening who wants to help us with that work, reach out. If you have questions, reach out.
Okay, great. And they can find you where? On the Global Carbon Reward website somewhere.
It's three words, globalcarbonreward.org. Just Google it. You should find it pretty easily. And there's a contact page there.
Well, thanks, Delton. It's been really interesting. And I'm always interested to find people who are proposing something that seems not to fit in the mold of any of the other categories that I'm aware of. So it's really, really interesting, and let's keep in touch. I hope this has been interesting for people in our movement, and also, you know, Extinction Rebellion in the UK have just done a whole load of actions on focusing specifically around the insurance industry, and obviously there are major issues there around the facilitation of carbon intensive projects, but really underlying it, a big an enormous question for me about why the insurance industry isn't recognizing systemic risk in a way which seems blatantly very obvious to me. So it's really good to talk to someone with a sort of a view from a different direction on risk and global systemic risk as well. So thanks very
Yeah.
much, Doc. Catch you soon, everybody. Thank you for watching.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.